I am Micah J. Best from the University of British Columbia, and my work generally focuses on what I refer to as complex systems, dealing with multi-core. Now, I don't have a hard and strict definition of what a complex system is, but basically, if you can't represent your system as a series of nested loops arranged generally in linear order, you're probably in complex system land. Now, I really like the term earlier from the multi-tenancy. It's as if your program already has multi-tenancy built in. Now, my favorite particular focus for complex systems is video games. Given the massive number of different algorithms, data structures, concerns, access types, are all going on at once, and they need to be responsive, and they're developed by massive teams. And so, we can begin this talk with a rather fun, motivating example. So what we see here is a pre-alpha build of the game Clockwork Empires. We can see the new citizens of the empire wander around, being productive, building buildings, living their lives. What we don't see is the tens of thousands of lines of code that drive the simulation, that literally track each citizen's hopes and dreams, and most importantly, structures that mediate how each citizen sees the world. And so we will. So the thing is, what is also not shown is the team of harried developers that are trying to put this together. From graphics experts to gameplay programmers, even to artists who for some reason we allow to write scripts. And exactly one of them, standing here, is a parallelism expert. None of the others would know a cache miss if it bit them somewhere. Okay, so now that I've got you hopefully a little bit interested with pretty pictures, the overview of my talk will go as follows. I'm going to start by giving a very, very high-level argument from my point of view on parallelism, trying to come up with a general solution. I don't have time to optimize every single one of the literally dozens of algorithms going on just in that picture that you saw. So I need a general thing, and I'm going to talk about how we think. Then I'm going to talk about basically, given those very abstract ideas, how we actually make them real. What are we going to use? What techniques do we need to modify the language? How are we going to do this? And finally, I'll give you some numbers. I'll show you how we took steps one and two and turned it into something that's really going on. Now, I want to be specific here and harp on that the main takeaway from my talk is that subcollections are a good candidate for the basic unit of parallelism. What do I mean by the basic unit of parallelism? That will come clear in a few slides. Now, if you go home and say to your husband, wife, that, you know, there was this crazy Canadian guy who's developing yet another parallel framework that supposedly is going to solve all our problems, then I failed today. But if I make you go, I wonder how this applies, I wonder if it applies, then I've won. And so let's start talking with a question. How do we think about parallelism? This is the mental model, even higher than the programming model. We are a visualizing species. For whatever reason, we tend to build little pictures in our heads of what's going on. And so after a few years in this field, I have sort of reverse engineered what I refer to as the undergrad model. We have a bunch of processors, we have a traditional serial program, and we take those pieces of the serial program and we assign them to processors. So we take the code and we schedule it. Now, I've noticed that in all my work on task parallelism, every time I go to write the introduction and give my definitions, I have trouble with one thing. What is a task? What is a job? What is the basic unit of work? And I often have to sort of wave my hands. And when discussing this with people from outside my field, generally with theoreticians, when talking about scheduling algorithms, it's very difficult to describe. Well, it's kind of this thing that the programmer defines, the kind of bunch it up, and then we just have to schedule it. So I want to delve into that a little bit. And now I want to quickly talk about data. Now, everybody, I think, in this room is familiar with these kind of things. And you're probably mentally filling in others that apply to your research, cross-cache hits, and of course, given this audience, we have the access time clouds, which is starting to apply more and more to video games with cloud rendering, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we also have to consider these are the costs of data. These is how it affects performance. But also, what are the problems in debugging? We have deadlock, live lock, load balancing, starvation, all of this that has to do with the data of our program. And problems that we have scheduling our code? Okay. Actually, I must admit that this morning I was reminded that I forgot about JIT. But there could be an argument that this is a transformation of data into code. And that sort of brings up the symbiotic relationship between these two things. Now, there's an expression whose provenance I was unable to trace that I really like for this. When you pick up one end of the stick, you pick up the other. So when you schedule data, the code comes along with it. But what happens if we pick up the other end of the stick? What happens if we start by considering data? What happens if we take our program and picture it as a series of assigning data to processors? Again, changing the mental model and scheduling data, not code. But that immediately brings up the question, what is this going to look like? What does a data schedule look like? What does that mean? And so the immediate problem with trying to even get your hands around it is that code is static. It's what the programmer has written, it's on disk, the compiler executes it, puts it out, whereas the data is dynamic, not just in value, but also in cardinality, multiplicity, etc. But luckily, data never travels alone. Okay, so in pedantry, I do have to sort of amend some of these statements. But when data doesn't travel alone, it comes in collections. We put things in lists, we put things in queues, we put things in maps, we put things in the entire contents of an undergrad algorithms course. And we rarely use a whole collection at once. So consider your favorite algorithm. That does, maybe it's a dynamic programming or a tree algorithm. And you can see that at each iteration, at each sort of step, we are looking at one part of it. So for example, inserting into a linked list, at one moment we are only simply looking at the predecessor and the successor of the element that we want to insert. And so this is basically what I use to try to answer my question from earlier. What is a work unit? What should we be trying to schedule? And I say that this is where I say the candidate for what we should be trying to schedule is the smallest set of sub-collections needed for processing in making forward progress in the application. A bit of a mouthful, but we have and this is sort of the chain of my argument from the most abstract, how are we thinking about this, to, okay, so we're going to try to deal with sub-collections. Now, that was my argument, but it's still not really actionable. I can't sit down and go, okay, I'm going to consider data, not code. What does that look like? And immediately, three problems come to mind. And I'm sure I can hear you thinking, Micah, only three? But three main ones that we should address immediately. How do we efficiently deal with sub-collections? Generally, in multiprocessor scheduling, we don't even have time to blink, much less do expensive all-to-all comparisons. We need some method to talk about sub-collections very, very quickly. How do we structure programs? Is there a change that we need to make to how programs are actually written? And how can we do this in a way that, as I say, appeals to the artists and gameplay programmers who make up the majority of, or the type of people who make up the majority of programmers writing programs? And finally, how do we derive schedules? How can we make a maximum efficient use out of this model? I'll be talking about the first two. The third one is included in work in progress. So for our particular implementation of these ideas, we use synchronization via scheduling, which is something I, So the basic idea of synchronization via scheduling is we want to know what data task is going to access before it executes and use this information to make scheduling decisions. And what we want to do is we want to derive a compact representation, a single bit spring of the space of potential accesses. Now, people ask me if that derivation of that bit string is worth it. Is it worth walking over the entire data structure, building the string so we can use it? And I will answer that shortly. So I've noticed a pattern in software. Whenever dealing with a sub-collection, or whenever dealing with a collection, the first thing that's generally done, this is not a universal pattern, but it's something that comes up again and again and again. We isolate the data we want to use, the sub-collection, we modify it somehow, and then we release it. And so this pattern comes up again and again and again, specifically in the stencil pattern, which is what we'll be using in that spatial example earlier. When a citizen interacts with the world, we isolate a certain square, in fact it's a circle, and that has to be locked for the entire time. But this comes up again in list modification, tree modification, and graph modification. Now not always, tree rebalancing requires the whole tree. Sometimes we want to use the same subcollection in the next step, but generally we should be supporting this. So I argue for first-class collections. Basically, in one word, retains, or in one phrase, retains semantic value. We ask the programmer to, we give the programmer the ability to determine what's in a collection and what's out of a collection. So in our implementation, we use the actor model, which provides a nice isolation. They can only interact from the model with messages. And these messages can be in the form of queries, which basically return an object that only allows access to items in that collection that match that query. So I'm running out of time, so I'm going to have to kind of go through here. So how did this all work out? So we have a sort of a simplified version of this, where each of these elements, or each of these citizens in this mass example, is running around. And I've marked in red how they are querying the spatial structure. And so you can see there's a chance for plenty of conflicts. And so how did this all work out? So I first implemented a simple global lock, and we get negative performance. I then did a very intricate progressive locking system, sort of more of the standard thing, locked each individual cells. We get more performance until we sort of basically run out of parallelism. And then using the general solution that I've just presented, we actually outperform the hand-coded solution. And to answer that question about derivation, I cached the values that are used to derive the signature representation. And so this doesn't actually do that. So you can see that that's not actually costing us that much. Yes?
So this signature thing, I
mean, I can
discuss
it very
briefly.
Yes.
I'll give you a question time, so you're good. Can you explain a little bit more
about
what this
signature implies? I can. In fact, I have some slides for it. If you just give me a second here. Okay, there should be a hotkey for this. Okay, so SVS signatures. So we have, I thought this might come up, so I prepared this extra slide. So we have a space. Now this could be all of memory, which is what we did in our original publications on synchronization via scheduling, or it could be just simply a collection. And what we do is we derive this bit string by basically dividing the space into roughly equal size portions. Each of the subspaces is represented by a single digit in the signature. Now, basically in practice, we generally end up doing this by hashing unique IDs. So it's what, you know, it's a representation of the ID space of the particular thing under contention. And so whenever an item is in one of these subspaces, we set that to one. whether there's one item in there or a dozen. And so what we have is we have a compact representation. Now, of course, this is, we lose precision here, but we know that something in that subspace is present. So this has many advantages. These are easily composable. In fact, we can even SIMD them. We can take signatures, quickly logical OR them together, and we have a representation of two spaces. And this is exactly what we're doing. We take the signature of each individual cell in our spatial query, and we basically OR them together as fast as possible to produce a bit string representation that represents that particular subcollection. And so when it comes time to schedule, all we have to do is simply compare two bit strings. The bit string representing what's currently being executed and the bit string of what we want to execute. If they are disjoint, then we're good to schedule. If they are not disjoint, we don't allow that new process into schedule. These are, say, quick to compute and compare. And this is important. They only have false positives for intersection. So if we, so at worst, if, as again, we lose precision when we take these signatures, but so at worst, we just simply don't schedule when we could have. So we take a performance hit. And it's easy to make arbitrarily precise. If you have too many conflicts because of this, you increase. If there's a memory trade-off, but I haven't really hit that yet. And this is also important. We separate the evaluation of data items from synchronization. So we can construct these signatures in a completely elided environment. We don't have to. This is why it beats the progressive locking, because the progressive locking has to actually interact with other threads for each cell that it locks. This can effectively calculate the effect of that lock before that scheduling decision happens. Okay. So just to jump back here, and so now if we take a look at this graph, higher is better. This is in frames per second, which is the currency of the game industry. So being higher is being better. And so as I say, so the red bar indicates where I magically, oracularly derive the signatures. And so two bits of future work, optimized scheduling. As I say, I didn't talk about that. How do we use this? And the second is robust query support. How do we allow the user to specify these queries really easily? Right now we have an implementation using C++ 11 lambdas, which you submit across the thing, and that tells whether it's admitted or not. And those are the two things. So again, I would like to give my heartfelt appreciation to the anonymous reviewers, who I assume are all in this room. Perhaps not. Okay, well, many of them are in this room. So pat yourself on the back. Even if my work had been judged to be not ready for prime time yet, the feedback I got was fantastic. And I'd like to thank Gaslamp Games for trusting me enough to apply my cutting-edge research to their production video game. So thank you.
Does that answer your question, or did I misunderstand?
So assume that I have a data structure.